Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the weekly Thursday morning edition of the Household Express, a program dedicated to all your homemaking needs. I am Sister Amara, joined by my co-host, Auntie Hawa Surti, and we're delighted to be in your company up to 11 a.m. this morning. Assalamu alaikum, Auntie Hawa, how are you keeping?
Alaikum salam, alhamdulillah, and hope to hear the same from
you. Are you feeling well, Auntie Hawa? How did your cataract op go?
Much better. I'm feeling quite good.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah for that, Auntie Hawa.
It went off quite quickly, actually. I think 15 minutes and it was done.
They're so advanced today, Auntie Hawa. Alhamdulillah
they
for
are
that.
Today. Yeah.
Yes. Well, listeners, indeed a bumper-packed, informative program coming your way this lovely summer morning in Johannesburg, South Africa, in Asia. Our topic is on halal versus halal friendly. What is the difference, and why, as Muslim consumers, should we be cautious about eating halal friendly? And my special guest online, we will be chatting to Fazana Alvarado, also known as Chef Sana. And later on in the program, in the cooking segment, we're going to be telling you about salted and unsalted butter. What's the difference, how to bake with them, and some baking tips as well. And recipes we're sharing with you today is scones recipes. I'm going to be sharing with you a petit pain scones recipe and a non-flop scones recipe as well. And today, well, listeners, we have an open line for any of your cooking and baking questions or concerns. You can WhatsApp us on 072-786-1548. Now, there is no secret that Muslims are big spenders when it comes to eating out. We may be a small minority in South Africa, but many brands and food outlets cater for Muslims. In the past 2 years, we have seen restaurants entice people by stating they are halal friendly. Fazana is known as Chef Sana, and she did a post a few months back on why halal friendly may be not so halal. Today we look at some of her reasons why she stays away from halal friendly altogether as a chef. Assalamu alaikum, Farzana. How are you?
Wa alaikum salam, Amara. Alhamdulillah, how are you?
Alhamdulillah, jazakallah for joining us once again. Always delighted to have you on the show.
Always a pleasure, jazakallah, for your invitation. Really appreciate it. Always so lovely to share with your listeners.
Shukran jazilan. Farzana, what is meant by halal friendly? And in your opinion, why has this term become so popular in the food industry?
There's a couple of reasons. So let's start off first of all with halal friendly. What exactly is halal friendly? Mm. So if you go to an establishment that is serving food that does not have a halal certification, generally they say that their food is halal friendly. And what they mean by that is their proteins, their chicken or their meat, is actually coming from a halal supplier. So there are quite a few halal suppliers. I won't mention any on air, but I'm sure that for your listeners, they are very familiar with which ones they are. So the establishments get those halal certified products, say a halal chicken, and they cater it on their menu. But why it's halal friendly and not halal is their kitchen is not certified halal. The other products are not certified halal. And even though they may be cooking with halal certified chicken, they're working, you know, alongside pork and alcohol in that kitchen. So a way to say it's okay for you to eat it because the chicken is halal, but our restaurant itself is not 100% halal. That's one way, in my opinion, to kind of entice a Muslim spender or a Muslim consumer to come in and spend money in that restaurant, feeling that they're eating halal chicken and so that there's no problems with it. My issue with it is working behind the scenes, working in restaurants, working in in the hospitality industry, in hotels, I get to see what is happening in those kitchens. And when you've got pork and alcohol in the kitchen alongside halal certified chicken and beef or meats, it's very, very difficult to control the contamination. Contamination happens. It happens. It's ongoing. Very often the staff at the establishment are not Muslim. If there is a Muslim person on staff, then it's easier to oversee because we are aware of what the halal and haram regulations are. But very, very often, I mean, it's few and far between to actually find Muslim people in the kitchen. The contamination is widespread, and it's very rarely controlled.
Now, Fazana, as a chef, you know the ins and outs of a kitchen. Can cross-contamination happen easily?
Pardon, I didn't get your question.
Can cross-contamination happen easily?
Yes, absolutely. Let me give you a couple of examples. Say, for example, you go into a restaurant to order pizza, and it's not a fully halal establishment, and you order pizza. I have had incidences prior to, you know, becoming a chef. I used to go to places that said they were halal friendly. And some of my personal experiences is you would order a pizza. How often do you turn over the pizza and look at the base? You don't.
Never. You just basically eat
it. And I've seen incidences of little pieces of ham or bacon stuck on the crust of a pizza on the underneath because it's being baked in the same pizza oven.
Sure.
And, you know, when the staff takes it out of the pizza oven and then cuts it in preparation for the consumer, generally they're using the same pizza cutter. Now, because of the move towards veganism and vegetarian, you find that they do actually sterilize or wash that pizza cutter, but some establishments don't. They are still very, use the word ignorant to say that they're ignorant about using it, and they would cut a ham pizza with the same pizza cutter without washing it as they would cut a vegetarian one. So that kind of contamination you definitely will find. Again, sandwiches is another one. Mm-hmm. Sandwiches, if you order a toasted cheese and tomato sandwich, it's being done on the same grill, the same flat top grill, or in the same salamander, the same toaster as a ham and cheese sandwich. You know, so there are ways to get around it. For example, if I was hard pressed to go into a restaurant that was not halal certified, I would then ask them to make a cheese and tomato sandwich for me, but to toast it separately by wrapping the entire sandwich in aluminium foil. Once it's wrapped in aluminium foil, they can go ahead and put it into that toaster for me, and I know it's not touching that bread or the filling in any way. And then, you know, obviously remove it from the aluminium foil and place it onto a plate for me. But that's one way to get away, you know, get over that situation. But there are others that we can't control. For example, deep fryers. Mm-hmm. When I was working in a very well-known 5-star hotel, we had incidences where we had people coming in and they would order sandwiches and order chips, like normal fried potato chips. And when I first started out as a chef intern, I wasn't aware about the level of contamination. And it was only when I started working in the industry that I realized how easy it is for things to get contaminated. And there was one incident where somebody had ordered a plate of chips. It was a Muslim family that came in and they ordered a plate of chips for all the members. You know, like everyone had a plate of chips along with whatever else I think it was the fish. And I had seen the actual member of staff who was preparing it for them pop those chips into the same deep fryer that the pork schnitzel had been fried in just minutes earlier.
Oh my goodness.
So that type of contamination is really stressful because you know that it's happening. And, you know, as a Muslim, I have a responsibility to speak out. I can't tell people, no, don't go and eat there or you shouldn't eat there. The best I can do is share the information of what I know based on my personal experience. And ultimately, it's the consumer's decision whether they want to eat or not. And, you know, the question that I have very often, for example, sushi is very trendy, popular.
Yes, yes.
I'm a sushi lover. So is my little boy. I mean, you know, we love it. And so do a lot of other Muslim people. But sushi sometimes is not always prepared in a halal way. For example, the fish is, but sushi can sometimes have the rice prepared with mirin or with rice wine vinegar. And this is, mirin, first of all, is an alcoholic liqueur. It has 14% of alcohol content and a 40 to 50% sugar content. But then people say, I'm cooking with rice wine vinegar, or it's got a splash of white wine vinegar in the salad dressing. Rice wine vinegar is actually rice that has had the outer husks removed and then it's been processed and distilled and fermented. And in that fermentation process, a natural alcohol occurs and it ends up with an 18 to 25% alcohol content. So sushi, you have to be very careful. I would say always inquire from the restaurant whether the sushi rice is prepared with mirin or rice wine vinegar you know, in that case, you can't consume it because it's just definitely not halal. People may also talk about soy sauce. I would say read the labels very, very carefully. Some of the soy sauce, well, most of the soy sauce in South Africa is imported, and a lot of it is imported from China or from Southeast Asian countries. Mm-hmm. Not all of them are halal. Yes. Some are. Mm-hmm. Always check the label to check if it's been, you know, with those regional bodies. I know in Malaysia, they send in one sometimes to South Africa, which is the Malaysian Islamic Council that actually certifies it halal. Mm-hmm. But generally, the very well-known ones like Kekkoman has an alcohol content in it. Tamari is also something else. It's a Japanese form of soy sauce. It also has an alcohol content as a result of the fermentation process. So those are things that I think people need to be aware of, that contamination is ongoing, contamination is very real, and you don't know exactly when you go into a place that is not fully halal certified exactly what's going on behind the scenes. So exercise caution, that's what I would advise.
You know, Vizana, sometimes some of the hotels will tell you it's halal friendly, and if you ask them, they say they've purchased the sausages on their meat or something for a halal certified butchery. Now, when that meat goes behind the scenes, is it mixed with the other meat? The non-halal meat?
Sometimes it can be. If you don't specify exactly what your criteria is for how it should be prepared, it can be. It's very easy to take a halal sausage and put it on the flat top with a pork banger. I've seen it happen. You know, it's shocking. But again, it comes down to education in the actual facility. So if you are a consumer, and look, I'm not going to be unrealistic. I know that when one travels, it's not always possible to find an establishment serving 100% halal food. And sometimes people are hard-pressed. You have to go into a place on your travel, you know, itinerary, and eat at a place that is not halal certified. And in that sense, always make sure to speak to the manager or the owner. Explain, for religious reasons, you cannot eat food that is contaminated. So, for example, if they could possibly fry your sausages in a clean frying pan with clean oil, specify the oil must be clean. They must not take oil that something else has been fried in and put into a clean pan, because that defeats the purpose. Always say, look, for religious purposes or allergy, you know, reasons, can it always be made separately in a clean utensil, in a clean dish, in a clean pan with clean oil? And in that sense, generally, they do comply. At the end of the day, they don't want to get into trouble as well. You know, they have a lot of vegans coming in, a lot of vegetarians coming in. So there are some regulations. I think there's more awareness around vegan and vegetarianism than there is around halal. Even though we have a very strong Muslim community in South Africa, and halal food, the availability is relatively widespread in South Africa compared to other places that I've been to worldwide, we're still very lucky. We do have access to that. But I think when you go into these establishments, always, always speak to the person in charge to make sure that the production or the producing of your food is overseen in the strictest manner, and be specific about that.
Vanna, let's talk about toasted cheese. If you're going to be ordering a toasted cheese sandwich from a sort of, okay, just say you're going to be traveling out. You said, no, you'll just stop on the road, you'll get a margarita pizza, or you'll get toasted cheese. But, you know, like we had a chat on the phone 2 days ago, you said the toasted cheese is actually toasted onto a toaster that maybe a ham and cheese sandwich is toasted on that. The same toaster, the same butter, the same knife is used, you know. Tell us more about that.
Okay, so first of all, when it comes to cheese, your cheese always has to be halal. And I'm going to be very specific in saying your cheese always must be halal. And this is what people don't realize. People generally think that cheese is cheese. It's a dairy product, and I can have any cheese anytime, anyhow. No, you can't. And the reason for this is cheese has to be set with a product called rennet. And rennet is sometimes derived from cows or from pork, right? And you have to check the packaging of your cheese to see what kind of rennet it's set with. Now, if it's vegetarian rennet, of course, go ahead and eat it. If it's microbial rennet, yes, of course, it's created in a lab, you can go ahead and eat it. But if that cheese packaging says animal rennet, and they don't often, you know, state that it's pork or beef, they generally say animal rennet, and it's not certified halal, please abstain, because it's generally pork rennet that is used to set cheese. The other thing is, if you are a cheese lover, please be aware against buying cheese that is imported from Europe. Always look for the type of rennet. Cheese that's coming in from Italy, from Belgium, from Amsterdam, or Netherlands in general, generally have pork rennet. So always, always look vegetarian rennet or microbial rennet on your cheese packaging. Alternatively, in South Africa, look for your halal certification. Now, there are some cheeses, very good cheeses in South Africa that are certified halal, that are, you know, 100% good, and you can go, you know, buy that anywhere, eat that anywhere. But please be cautious when it comes to the other ones. Now, with regards to sandwiches being toasted on the same flat-top grill, the same applies. It's the same thing. Ask for it to be wrapped in aluminium foil before it's toasted. Because, yes, contamination on those flat-top grills are real. They, you know, bacon is generally fried on there. Eggs are generally fried on there. So you have to be specific. If you are toasting my sandwich, do it, wrap it separately and put it into your toaster. Alternatively, do it a separate way and see what they can offer you. If you're asking for eggs as well, that's the other thing. The eggs and bacon are generally fried on the same surface. Generally, always ask them first, is it fried on the same surface as your bacon product? If it is, ask for it to be done separately.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no harm in asking questions, and
yes,
I think the only way...
I think we have the right to do so.
100%. And if you are consuming there, you have every right, you know, to, for your own well-being and for your own health and for your own religious reasons as well, you have every right to ask those questions. And if you're uncomfortable with it, see if you can find a way around it and ask them to prepare it separately for you. Most establishments will not say no, because at the end of the day, they want to make their customers happy. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, please be aware that there is contamination happening behind the scenes, because a lot of staff are unaware of the halal haram issue, and they don't know the limitations. Some people might think it's halal. They know that it's meat. They don't know how it's processed. They don't know how the meat is slaughtered. They don't know any of that. They just know the word halal, and it's kind of like a buzzword. Others might say, oh, but we've got vegetarian and vegan stuff, so I can offer you that. Fine. Perfect, but how is it being produced in the back? Because if you're frying your, you know, your vegetarian pepper slices on the same surface as something else, then that's a problem. So always just be careful and ask and see if they can assist you.
Okay. Fazana, what about the cutlery, the dishes, the pan marie, the toasters, the ovens, the microwaves, you know? Tell us about that. How is it basically sanitized for halal purposes? Is it sanitized in the first place behind the scenes?
You know, when a restaurant is very, very busy and we've got 100 people sitting out front and everybody wants their food now and there's 40 people in the kitchen working frantically behind, there's generally not always time to sanitize after every single dish that is being made. And that's where the biggest contamination happens. For example, if somebody is warming, defrosting pork sausages in a microwave, it's very unlikely that that person is going to sanitize that microwave afterwards. Very unlikely. That's where the halal control has to be in place. And if there isn't a Muslim person in the kitchen overseeing that, or even a non-Muslim person that is very, very clued up on halal, it's not going to happen. That's just the reality. They're working at such a speed back there. They're working, you know, so fast, and every little dish counts. But that attention to detail also lacks when it comes to religious requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not just us that have this problem as well. The very strict Jewish people that are, you know, kosher, they also have the very same. In fact, you know, they can't even eat things like fish and meat on the same in the same dish. Fish and milk. Fish and milk can't be combined in the same dish. So it's very, very strict. So, yeah, contamination is real. And it does come down to, I think, education. Not much is given in terms of education. And I'm actually trying to speak to some culinary schools at the moment to try and facilitate that. And I'm also engaging with relevant industry bodies to see how we can include more halal in the curriculum. So when we actually train junior chefs about it, they are more aware of what the requirements are.
Lovely idea. Definitely a much need for that, you know, and we greatly appreciate that also. And you know, Fazana, now, you know, it's certain hotels now, since COVID started, when you're going there for the breakfast, they have everything wrapped, the cereal wrapped in a bowl, it's cling wrapped, your cakes, your fruit, brought it in the front. But when it goes behind scenes, behind in the kitchen, is it cross-contaminated with other products?
With the fruits and cereals, no, because the kitchen is divided in a certain way. We have a hot kitchen and we have a cold kitchen. So the cold kitchens would generally work with things like your salads. It would work with your cereals, your fresh fruit. Everything is chopped, cut, prepared separately, and we have a special team that's generally working with that. I would caution, though, if you are working or ordering a salad, always inquire that it's done separately, because sometimes some salads have bacon bits in it.
Yes.
You know, so you don't want to get a bacon bit in your salad when you're choosing something. So always inquire that it's done away, and then any cutlery that they use or tongs that they use is sterilized and washed before the preparation of your food. And then the hot kitchen works separately. They will have somebody working only with the hot meat section or the hot porridges or, you know, the hot sandwiches section. And that's where the meat products is, the alcohol products is, and that's where more of the contamination actually happens.
Mm-hmm. For a lovely interview. It really opened our eyes so much. And I'm sure most of the listeners also will take heed from this now with the upcoming holidays as well. You know,
yes.
And for me, I can say that it's halal or haram. Definitely not. There's no such a thing as halal family, halal friendly.
Nothing.
Yes.
Your
closing remarks,
Fazana. I can 100% say to you that there is no such thing as halal friendly. The word halal friendly has basically been made up to kind of call in or lure in a Muslim customer. Now, some people might not like me using the word lure because it sounds a little bit sneaky, but at the end of the day, the word is coined to make you believe something that it's not,
mm-hmm.
which I have a big problem with, because when you say halal friendly, the disclaimer should be, yes, our meat is sourced from a halal supplier, but there is contamination in our kitchen.
Yes.
They
yes.
should say it outright that there mm-hmm. is contamination. Okay. And this is their way of kind of finding it, getting around the issue. So when you actually complain and say, oh, but you said it's halal friendly, but I found a piece of bacon in my
mm-hmm.
sandwich, they're going to come back to you and say, yes, but we told you the meat is halal friendly, meaning from a halal supplier. We did not tell you that our kitchen is halal. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is a way, I think, a way of them getting away around it to try and please every customer. But that is also not possible. Amara, just something that I want to highlight.
Please, please.
I'm very aware that people say that the type of halal food people get in South Africa is very limited. And, you know, you ask for halal, it's generally curries, it's generally, you know, grilled. And people want to sometimes experience different cuisines. And I had somebody send me a direct message on Instagram about this, saying, oh yes, it's all good and well talking about halal and halal friendly, but what about those of us that want to experience a different cuisine and we don't have any options in our community?
Mm.
You know, that's up to the consumer where they want to eat, and I totally understand that there's a lack of it. So, you know, everybody will choose to eat where they want to eat at the end of the day, but as long as the information is out there, that people are aware of what's really happening behind the scenes. And also, you know, if you're talking about different cuisine as well, I would like to share something that I'm, if I may,
yes,
something
yes,
that
yes.
I'm currently
mm-hmm.
working on. So my background is, you know, I'm a chef, obviously professionally, and people are welcome to follow me on my Instagram. My Instagram handle is chef_Zana, and I specialize basically in quick, easy meals for busy people, because I'm a busy mom. I've got two little live wire children that are, you know, running me in circles most of the time. So I want quick, healthy, nutritious, family-style meals that can be put together in a very little time. And I specialize in global flavors. I do different types of dishes. So people from Turkish to Mongolian dishes, Vietnamese, you name it, I do it on my channel. And people are welcome to get recipes and ideas on there. And one of the things that I'm going to be launching next week, in fact, is a concept called Mestizo Latin American Cuisine. So personally, I've done courses in Latin American cuisine whilst I was in Latin America, but also I'm married to a Latin American, and you know, being a half South African, half Latin American family, mm-hmm. but also Muslim, our taste profile is a little bit different in what we like as a family. So we've created this halal Latin American cuisine concept that will be launching next week, where we focus on proper, authentic Mexican tacos, Argentinian food, Peruvian food, and Brazilian.
Mm.
So watch out on my Instagram channels and my Facebook for more information, and you guys can find out where you can find me and where you can come and try some different cuisines.
Jazakallah khair, and all the best for your new venture as well, Fazana.
Ameen.
And we've got lots and lots of messages of appreciation for this interview to you as well, for bringing so much of attention to us on halal and haram and what's cross contamination. Like I said again, there's no such a thing as halal friendly. It's either halal or it's either haram.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And just an open invitation to your listeners as well. If anybody would like to message me on direct message for any advice, or you have any concerns, or you'd like to figure out how to use pantry ingredients, you're welcome to contact me on DM. I think the last time I did a radio interview, I had quite a few moms calling to say, you know, their kids want to get involved in the hospitality industry. What subjects should they choose? And I was able to advise them and point them in the right direction. So if any of your listeners would like to contact me, please do. I'm more than happy. And you're very welcome to contact me on those channels. So Instagram, Chef_Zana, and Chef Zana on Facebook as well.
Jazakallah khair for Zana. You enjoy the rest of the day. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Well, that was Chef Sfarzana, and she's given us quite a detail of the so-called thing as halal friendly. There is no such a thing as halal friendly. It's either halal or haram, and what goes on behind the scenes in the kitchen or the hospitality industry as well, certain hotels and that, not to mention the names as well, but definitely an eye-opener for all of us. And I'll reward her for her kindness to bring that to our attention as well, so that we as Muslims should know from where to eat and where not to eat from. Okay, let's go for a short break. When we come back, we're talking about salted and unsalted butter. And you're welcome to send in any of your cooking and baking questions or concerns. 072-786-1548. Stay tuned. Assalamu alaikum and welcome back. Welcome back, Auntie Hava. How are you keeping?
Alhamdulillah.
Indeed, a eye-opener interview with Chef Zana a few minutes ago.
Really was a good one.
It just shows what happens behind the scenes in the hospitality industry as well. You know that we feel they say it's halal friendly, so there is no such a thing as halal friendly. It's either halal or it's either haram. And even if they tell you they're buying the meat from a halal certified butcher, but behind the scenes they actually, it's all cross contaminated.
Lots of contamination.
And Al Khalid rewarded for bringing that to our attention, you know. And it was so nice to have her on and to share that with the listeners out there as well. And so many listeners are so grateful for this interview as well. And listeners, the podcast will be up later on in the show. Later on, say about another hour's time. And we will post that link to you. You can follow me on Instagram at Amara_Mullah, or go on to the Radio Islam website, radioislam.co.za. Well, Auntie Hava, salted versus unsalted butter. Does what kind of butter you choose matter when it comes to cooking and baking? We settle the salted versus unsalted butter debate, Auntie Hava.
Okay, firstly, let me just mention about the cream of tartar. Actually, cream of tartar, bicarb, etc., is all manufactured chemically. We don't wait for the wine to be made before we get cream of tartar.
Okay.
Because there's such a big demand for these sort of ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just clarify that point our minds are at rest. Okay, let's come now to the topic of today, the salted and unsalted butter. They are more or less the same thing. They are made from churned cream. One has salt and one doesn't. Both can be used in baking, but if you are using unsalted butter in baking, you will find that the texture and the taste of the end product will be slightly creamier. Whereas if you use salted butter, then it will have a different taste altogether, because the salt kind of controls the flavor. When you're using these butters, one can be substituted for the other. And if you are using unsalted butter, you will take your measurements or read your recipe correctly, and then you will take your butter. Say you're using half a cup, you would add a quarter teaspoon of salt to that.
Okay.
And if you are using salted butter, then you don't need to add any salt. But with baking, it's always nice to add a good pinch of salt to all your baking. It does do the flavor good, because we can really taste what we are eating. And you cannot, unfortunately, you cannot substitute margarine for butter.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm.
But many of us do bake with margarine, and the results are quite good and quite tasty.
Okay. And if you're baking with salted butter and unsalted butter, with salted butter, if you're baking the same recipe with salted butter and unsalted butter, you will know the difference, Antiava.
Yes, you will know the difference, because if you are going to spread a slice of toast with butter, you prefer to use salted butter because of the taste.
Mm-hmm.
When you take these butters into consideration, the salted butter, salt is a preservative, so the shelf life of that butter will be longer, for example, for about 5 to 6 months, whereas the unsalted butter will only last for about 3 to 4 months.
Okay.
So the salt does play an important role in the butter itself.
Okay. When do you use salted butter, Antiava?
When the recipe asks for it.
Okay.
But it's not really important. You can use either butter. Just remember that if you're using unsalted butter, you've got to add a good pinch of salt to your mixture.
Okay. Is salted butter better than unsalted butter?
No. No, there's no... You cannot say that, because the end product usually determines the taste of your food.
Okay.
So salted butter and unsalted butter works in the same principle.
Okay. Only the taste will be different. For instance, if you're making a cake with salted butter, it will taste different to a cake made with unsalted butter.
Yes. It will also tell you or give you a different texture.
Okay.
Unsalted butter will give you a slightly softer texture, whereas salted butter slightly. But the difference is so, it's not marked. The difference is so small that you won't even notice.
All right. And Yava, when it comes to making pastries, you know, can you make pastry dough with salted and unsalted butter? What difference would you see in that?
Yes, you can definitely use either salted or unsalted butter. But you've got to add the salt for the flavor. And the difference will be negligible, because you're using the same procedure of the rolling and the folding, etc., in both, if you're using any of the butters.
Okay, okay. And if you're making, now I'm going to be sharing with you some lovely scone recipes as well. Can you make scones with unsalted butter?
Yes, you can. But like we mentioned earlier, you use your unsalted butter. It's not harmful to use unsalted butter.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that salt is not added to the butter.
Okay. Can you make ghee with unsalted butter, Antiava?
Yes, you can.
And you use the same procedure, only your taste will be different.
Only the taste will be different.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm. And that ghee with the unsalted butter will not last so long as the ghee with the salted butter.
Because salt is more of a preservative as well.
It's a preservative, yes.
Okay. And Deva, can you share with us some tips on making scones?
Okay, scones, it's a quick mix, like pancakes. So if you are making scones, the butter must be cold.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because you are going to rub it into the flour, the first instruction or the first method that you're going to use, you're going to rub the butter into the flour so that it resembles breadcrumbs. We do this because we want to separate the flour grains so that when you are baking the scone itself, the butter provides a little bit of moisture so that it causes it to rise quite well. So rubbing the butter into the flour is a very important stage. And of course, your hands must also be cold.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Your fingers. You must rub it in with your fingertips and not with the palms.
Okay.
Because your palms are much warmer than your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can even use a pastry cutter.
All right. It's even better, Antiava. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can use a pastry cutter to cut the butter into the flour. And you've got to, when you are mixing the scone, when you're adding the liquid must be cold.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? And don't over-mix.
Yes, yes.
Just mix it just enough till you've got all the flour bits incorporated. And when you are going to shape the scone, the best way to do it is to press the dough down with the palm of your hand, don't use a rolling pin. Because you're working with amounts of like maybe 2 cups of flour.
Yes.
So there's not a large amount of dough to handle.
No.
So all you do is press it down with the palms of your hand, and using a cutter, which is dipped in flour, you cut out your scones, and whatever pieces you have left, you can roll into a ball and shape it into a scone.
All right, okay. And Jeffrey, if you're using self-raising flour, should you use unsalted butter when you're making scones?
I don't think it really matters.
Okay.
As long as you add, you use the butter and you add that pinch of salt.
Okay. And, all right, that's for scones. And scones should be baked on, say, if you preheat your oven to 220 or 200, and when you put your scones in, you bring it down to 180. Or if you're preheating it to 220, you bring it down to 200.
Yes, you can do that for the first 5 to 8 minutes, and then you drop it down to 180.
Okay. And remember, scones bake very quickly. And the thicker you roll your scones, the better. You get a nice, nice big-sized scone.
That you can achieve when you are packing the scones on your baking sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Put them close together.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Don't put them far apart like you would bake biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
You put them close together, so for some reason or the other, they help each other to rise.
All right, okay. And Eva, can you freeze scones?
Yes, after you've baked them, you can freeze them and thaw them out slightly before you warm them up in the microwave, and then you serve it.
All right. Well, that was for butter and scones. Let's go to our WhatsApp messages. The listener says, Salam, do I have to boil lemons for lemon achar? And how? And do I leave them whole? A recipe will help. Shukran.
To boil lemon?
For lemon achar. And do I leave them whole?
Yes, I would. But don't boil them for too long.
All right. Okay.
Probably 2 to 3 minutes the most.
Okay. Maybe the listeners can help us out with that. When you're making lemon achar, do you have to boil the lemons beforehand? Or do you just marinate it and leave it to marinate for a while and then you get a nice lemon achar? Perhaps the listeners can help us out. 072-786-1548. We would greatly appreciate that, okay?
Actually, with the lemon achar, you don't really boil the lemons.
Yes,
I don't think so.
I've never made lemon achar, no. I've never made that.
I've made it many years ago, but now they seem to have forgotten how.
Yes. And the listeners could help us out with that one. 072-786-1548 is our WhatsApp number as well. Tell us, how do you make your lemon achar? Do you boil the lemons? How long do you marinate it? We'd love to hear from you. Okay, this one says, Salams, what about yogurts and cheeses? Most in supermarkets are not halal anymore. Well, yogurts, I've seen, there is quite a few brands that's halal. You could just pick up the packet of yogurt, the small container of yogurt, and see if it has a halal stamp on, as well as cheeses as well. Certain cheeses are halal. You just need to go and see which one is certified by which halal authority as well.
And sometimes, Sister Amara, listeners have to be aware, the cheeses are cut up from a big block and wrapped into cling wrap. And there's no such thing as halal signs, etc. on it.
So before
you purchase it, go and ask the person behind the counter where the cheese came from and whether it is halal or not.
Okay. And then, Auntie Hava, how do you store cheese? You know, I feel that the cheese you buy today sometimes doesn't last very long.
You wrap it in aluminium foil and you can freeze it. Well, what I do is I grate the cheese first, put it into a plastic container and freeze it.
All right, okay.
And that lasts quite long.
Okay. Coming back to our story on the unsalted butter, the listener says, I only use unsalted butter for ghee and it comes out much better and there's no much less of the stuff that forms on top and I can strain it easily. Jazakallah for a lovely program. Ameen. Okay, so the listener says she actually makes ghee with the unsalted butter.
It's a bit difficult to find unsalted butter.
I think in the big stores, in the big supermarkets, you do get.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. All right. This one says, lovely program, mashallah. Just made ghee using unsalted butter. Came out lovely. Alhamdulillah, and yes, I freeze my scones after I cut them once. Frozen, I pack them in Tupperware and bake in petty pancake trays. It's lovely. Mashallah, jazakallah, from Sister Nafisa in the UK.
Oh, lovely.
Okay, it's great to know from somebody, Sister Nafisa is listening to us from the UK. Jazakallah khair. The listener says, coming back to the achar, lemon achar tip, assalamu alaikum, boil the lemons whole for 10 minutes, allow to cool completely, then mix with masala, there will be no patanas. Okay, that's a
okay,
nice tip. Okay,
that's a good tip.
A good tip. So it might be so easy to make lemon achar then, Auntie Ava.
Yeah, I'm sure, and I'm sure the masala is going to be some green chilies. And some red chilies.
Yes,
the coarse one.
The coarse red chilies as well, yeah. Okay. Another tip on lemon achar. Boil lemons for 10 minutes to take the bitterness out, then cut lemons in a dish. Don't let syrup run out. Put methi masala, add a little arad and red chilies to taste, and a little vinegar.
There's a very good lemon achar recipe in the Indian Delight.
Yes, yes.
Actually for the kumquats.
Okay.
It works out excellent.
Mm-hmm.
When I make that one, I usually reserve a little bit of the syrup, and then I cut lemon. I don't boil the lemon. I think I'm too lazy.
Okay.
I just take the lemon, cut it into nice wedges or pieces, depending on how you like it, and put it into that syrup.
Okay. This one says, salams, boil lemons with sugar and salt for 3 minutes, then cool. It takes away the bitterness. So I think boiling the lemons actually basically takes away the bitterness.
To get rid of the bitterness.
Okay. All right, let's go for our break. When we come back, we're sharing with you two lovely recipes. I've got a petty pan scones recipe and a non-flop scones recipe. So get your papers and pens on hand to jot down these lovely recipes. Stay tuned. Assalamu alaikum and welcome back. Let's go to our recipe segment of the program. And today I'm sharing with you two lovely scone recipes. The first one is a petty pan scones. The ingredients are as follows. 3 cups flour, 3/4 cup icing sugar, 3/4 cup icing sugar, 6 teaspoons baking powder, 6 teaspoons baking powder, 4 ounces butter, 4 ounces butter, and 1/4 cup oil, 1/4 cup oil. Now beat all the above ingredients together in a measure mix, then add in 3/4 cup sour milk, 3/4 cup sour milk, 1/4 cup water, 1 egg and a little vanilla essence, 1 egg and a little vanilla essence. Then you grease your patty pans, your cupcake pans well. Scoop 1 tablespoon in each patty pan, brush with egg, and bake at 180 degrees until light brown. The next recipe is a non-flop scones recipe. The ingredients are 3 cups flour. That's 3 cups flour, 1 cup icing sugar, 1 cup icing sugar, 6 teaspoons baking powder, 6 teaspoons baking powder, 1/4 pound butter, 1/4 pound butter, 1 cup sour milk, 1 cup sour milk, and 1 egg. So you preheat your oven to 220 degrees, mix together flour, icing sugar, baking powder, and butter into Magic Mix or baking machine. Then you mix together sour milk and egg and add to above mixture. Make a nice soft dough, then roll and cut into desired shapes. Brush egg on scones and reduce oven to 200 degrees when you put your tray in. Thereafter, bake scones until done. Indeed, a lovely scones recipe. Both recipes are very, very tasty and easy recipes to make. Auntie Hava?
Sister Amara, 1/4 pound butter, mm-hmm, is 1 cup, which is 125 grams.
Okay, all right, okay.
It's just to help the business. And another thing about scones, Sister Amara, when you're baking scones, you bake them close together, and when they are ready, it takes about 12 minutes to bake a tray of scones.
Yes.
You've got to knock it with your finger, and if it sounds hollow, that means it is baked.
Okay, lovely. And the listeners want us to repeat Sister Fazana's Instagram account. It's chef_Zana. So Z-A-N-A. H. Okay, so it's chef_Zana. You can follow her on Instagram. And recipes on our website, radioslam.co.za. Our podcast of the show will be up a little later on on the website as well. And I will be sharing the podcast link on my Instagram, Amara_Mula. Well, jazakallah to my producer, Mumtaz, Auntie Hava, our engineer, Yazdan as well. Inshallah, back with you with another lovely topic, lovely interview guest for next week, inshallah. Jazakallah to her, Auntie Hava, for all the valuable information.
Sister Mara, one more thing.
Yes, sure.
You can make your scone dry ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Dry ingredients. You can rub the butter in, add the baking powder, and after rubbing the butter into the flour, then you can put it into a plastic container, Ziploc bag, and you can keep it in the fridge until you are ready to use it. Then you're just going to add your liquid ingredients, and your scones will be ready in 10 minutes.
So easy, Auntie Hava, so easy and so filling, perfect for ideal breakfast and lunch. And scones is so filling.
And you can make a variety of scones. You can make savory ones, and you can make sweet ones. You can even use nutty wheat in the flour.
Yes.
To get date and nut scone.
Lovely, Auntie Hava. Jazakallah khair for sharing that with us. And well, from me, Amara and Auntie Hava, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.